Here on BBC Radio 4 FM now, our new book of the week. Henry and Mary Ponsonby, Life at the Court of Queen Victoria. Geoffrey Palmer reads from this fascinating account of Queen Victoria's private secretary and his marriage to the clever and witty Mary Bulteel.
Windsor Castle is arranged along a steep slope above the River Thames. The Norman Tower is high up on the hill at the entrance to the upper ward. It is a large, self-contained house within the walls of the castle. Its three principal rooms have windows that overlook a dry moat, which serves as a garden. A warren of rooms at the back of the Norman Tower look out onto the central quadrangle of the castle and onto the windows of the apartments inhabited by the royal family. The different staircases and corridors, ranging off in odd directions, are enough to baffle weak-kneed guests, as well as to delight children. This was the house Henry and Mary Ponsonby, together with their five children, moved into in the summer of 1870. It was a grace and favour residence that went with Henry Ponsonby's new appointment as private secretary to Queen Victoria, and was to be their home for 25 years. As well as being private secretary, for 17 of those years he was also keeper of the privy purse. He was one of the most important people in the Queen's court, although his impulse was always to deprecate what he did and make light of his position. He was a quiet man with a disarming sense of humour. A nervous official who came to meet the Queen would find Ponsonby wearing a frayed tailcoat and elastic-sided boots. Ponsonby would give the man a warm welcome and then make some unexpected remark that would make the man laugh and forget his nervousness as he was being ushered in to meet the sovereign. Mary Ponsonby, having been appointed a maid of honour to the Queen in 1853, was as familiar with the court as her husband. She resigned her appointment on her marriage to Henry, but remained at the centre of the court's social life at Windsor for another 30 years. She delighted in pastimes usually favoured by men, and she had a carpentry shop in the Norman Tower, carpentry being a hobby she had learnt from her father. She was also a keen billiards player. In 1871, when Henry was away at Sandringham with the Queen, one of the equerries, Dudley de Roos, reported to Henry with mildly arched eyebrows, "Mrs. Ponsonby has been distinguishing herself in the billiard room during your absence." The Norman Tower may have been a grace and favour residence, but its decorations and equipment were as unconventional as the couple who lived there. The principal hallmarks of Ponsonby family life in the 1870s were love between parents and children communicated through shared jokes, and the demands of Henry Ponsonby's office with the Queen. The other characteristic of their lives together was a taste for discussion and argument. Their private family taste for muscular debate was at one with a great public tradition. For this was an era when parliamentary debate was at its prime. Politicians stood on their feet until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning at Westminster, and their speeches were reported word for word in the columns of the Times. These same men came regularly to Windsor, walking under the gateway of the Norman Tower, seeing the Queen, and calling upon the Ponsonbys as well. It was a time when people were convinced that political debate mattered, and the Ponsonbys' confidence in parliamentary democracy was a small but significant underpinning of the debates at the family dinner table. The correspondence between husband and wife carries on in much the same vein as the argumentative, jokey tone of the table. Henry Ponsonby wrote his wife a daily letter, as his position with the Queen meant that he and Mary were often separated for up to 3 months in the year. The ladies and gentlemen of the court moved when the Queen moved, but their husbands and wives usually stayed behind. This was a source of distress to both Henry and Mary, though perhaps he felt it more than she did. In 1873, having just been parted from her, he wrote, "Your letter with my things just arrived. and I have a fit of emotions reading your dear, dear words, and don't know how to tell you how very much I treasure them. Everything in my life is bound up so entirely with you that I can see and hear nothing but what is connected with you. This makes it so severe to be dragged away from you so continually, for I feel it is lost life. Nevertheless, they survived these separations, and their marriage endured for more than 30 years. Henry Ponsonby was born on Corfu on the 10th of December, 1825. His father, Frederick Ponsonby, a veteran of Waterloo, commanded the British garrison there. His mother, Lady Emily Ponsonby, was a daughter of Earl Bathurst, who held cabinet office nearly continuously from the turn of the century until the fall of the Tories in 1832. Henry was their first child. The key to Henry's gravity and conscientiousness as a young man was the unexpected death of his father when he was 11 years old. Henry now became the man of the family, a considerable burden for a boy not yet in his teens. At his school near Kingston-on-Thames, he had to decide on which of the armed forces he would train for afterwards. His father had been a soldier, and he would be one too. Taking his mother's advice, he went to the Royal Military College at Sandhurst, where he proved to be a faultless cadet, winning praise for his uniformly good conduct, gentlemanlike manners, and general attention to his studies. In 1844, the Duke of Wellington offered him a commission in the Grenadier Guards. Henry revered the Duke and marked the anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo in his diary and letters all his life. It was a high honour, conferred chiefly because of his father's place close to the Duke during the Peninsular Wars. He was hugely pleased and determined to live up to the accolade. A new opportunity presented itself in 1846 when Henry came of age. Henry's uncle, Lord Besborough, was sent to Ireland to serve as viceroy, and he took his nephew with him. The appointment to the suite of the Irish viceroy was Henry's first step on the ladder to high office. He confessed in a memoir of his time in Ireland that the private secretary's office at the Viceregal Lodge was not one of the strict, hard-working places, but was occasionally cheerful. In fact, his life consisted of going to parties, arranging transport, or copying letters for the viceroy. And he walked almost every day to Dublin Castle to have luncheon and see acquaintances. He lived in the Viceregal Lodge, an elegant, low-slung Georgian house surrounded by trees in Phoenix Park, just outside Dublin. Queen Victoria, who visited in 1849 and also stayed in the house, remarked on its views of the Wicklow Hills. Over the 9 years of his Irish service, Henry acted as private secretary to five viceroys. Of these, Lord Clarendon was the most important, because he took Henry's education in hand, as well as recommending him for a series of high-flying positions. Clarendon taught his young protégé to be sceptical of any royal claims to authority outside those ratified by Parliament. For Clarendon, princes were a sort of necessary evil. He honoured Prince Albert and Queen Victoria, to whom he was unfailingly and mischievously polite. They trusted and relied on him, but behind their backs, like many of the other Whig nobles, he called them Joseph and Eliza, the patronising 19th-century equivalents of Keith and Brenda today. The beginning of the Crimean War brought the recall of all officers to their regiments. Henry returned to England, saw his mother, and as a last gesture before embarking, had himself photographed. The photograph itself has not survived, but the act suggests that he knew there was a chance that he might not come back. On the night of the 24th of August, 1855, Henry experienced his first command in the trenches. He was in charge of a working party instructed to extend and deepen trenches that were in front of a Russian fortification defending Sebastopol. He assembled his men at 7 in the evening, when it began to grow dark. The soldiers set to work, everyone speaking in whispers, as the Russians were less than 200 yards away. Suddenly, the moon came out. The Russians opened fire. One of his men was killed and several more were wounded. A round shot hit the parapet behind which Henry and several others had taken cover. He recorded in his diary, "I was knocked in a hole. Three or four men fell upon me, and a heap of stones and rubbish." Henry struggled to breathe. Someone pulled him out, covered in chalk dust. One of his fellow officers said that in the moonlight, "I looked like the ghost of the Commendatore in Don Giovanni." Henry's night in the trenches did not end until 6 o'clock the next morning, as the men supposed to relieve him had been sent elsewhere. In the course of the evening, the commanding officer in the trenches was wounded, and for a short while Henry replaced him, without having a distinct idea of what to tell subordinates who approached him for orders. The heat and thirst was overwhelming. The noise was frightening. He wrote, "One soon gets accustomed to the sounds of the shot and shell, but the horrible noise of the rockets always startles one." After it was all over, unusually for him, he noticed the dawn. He saw the world around him afresh, and recorded in his diary, "It was the most lovely morning." He concluded by noting that on each of the three following nights, an officer was killed on the very same spot where he himself had been. When he sailed back to England in 1856, he was sailing rather at a loss. He had grown an enormous beard in the Crimea and sketched himself wearing it before having it shaved off. He could not so easily remove the deep impressions warfare had made upon him. He was changed from the non-committal young man who had lived at the Vice-Regal Lodge in Ireland. He was not at a loose end for long. In January 1857, Prince Albert appointed him as an equerry, an honour, and a welcome addition to his pay, for he now became richer by £500 a year, a large sum. Henry was deeply affected, perhaps unconsciously, by the prince's highly intellectual seriousness. As a equerry, he accompanied the prince to lectures, exhibitions, and meetings of the Fine Arts Commission. The very first month that Henry was in waiting on the prince, he saw the new round reading room at the British Museum. He listened to a lecture by the genius of chemistry and physics, Michael Faraday. A few months later, he and the prince attended a lecture on glaciers given by John Tyndall, another prominent pioneer of Victorian science. All this rubbed off on Henry Ponsonby. Under the prince's influence, he became a bookish young man, decidedly different from the other soldiers and sportsmen at court. His family background, Ireland, the Crimea, and his service as equerry to the prince consort all had an important effect in shaping Henry Ponsonby's personality. More important than any of these, however, was the woman whom he married in the spring of 1861.
And in tomorrow's episode, a young Mary Bulteel becomes maid of honour to Queen Victoria and meets her future husband. Geoffrey Palmer was reading Henry and Mary Ponsonby, Life at the Court of Queen Victoria by William M. Coon. The producer is Elizabeth Allard.